Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We are happy to begin sharing a new book with you today after a hiatus of several weeks. We welcome any feedback you might have on our interim series, Screen Guild Theater, which has been airing since the beginning of this year. But let's get on with our new reading by longtime KTWH volunteer, Tom Kohler. We'll let Tom introduce the book himself. Take note, this book will have 15 episodes, so be sure to tune in again tomorrow for episode 2. And for the next 3 weeks at this time on KTWH 99.5 FM and KTWH.org.
Whistling Pines is a mystery story set in a highly fictionalized version of Two Harbors. The story is written by Dean Hovey and copyrighted in 2012. Mr. Hovey has given us permission to broadcast his stories, and he says this was self-published and is the first in a series. This book is a work of fiction. Any resemblance to actual events is coincidental and unintended. People and places are fictional or used fictionally. Hugo's Bar is real, and if you get the chance to stop off for a beer or to catch some live music, please say hi to Tony and Sheila, the owners. Wendy resembles my wife's delightful cousin, Wendy, who sings like an angel. Miriam Milam is a real person who happens to be a human dynamo and the owner of off-the-farm products. I hope the endorsement makes up for describing the Miriam character as sturdy. Acknowledgements. Every book finds its genesis in a string of experiences, suggestions, and encouragement. I have to credit Brian Johnson, formerly of Two Harbors, for his persistent nudging, for giving me the catalyst that got the creative juices flowing, and for providing a sprinkling of Two Harbors history. After pecking away at the story for more than a year, I wasn't sure the light storyline and my attempted humor were going to come through for a reader. Special thanks to Nancy Moore, who offered to look at my very rough first draft. Her email the next day gave me the confidence to forge ahead. Her message, when's the sequel? Thanks to my mother-in-law, Hilder, who delighted me with her story about going to a rural Minnesota funeral to hear the bagpipes. She didn't know the decedent or the family, but she reported that the pipers and church lunch were wonderful. She also suggested the recipe for canned green peas in lime jello. Following some rewrites, trusted proofreaders helped me through some technical and structural glitches. Thanks to Clem and Anne McElravy, Dennis Arnold, Wendy Plauda, Miriam Milam, Franny Brozo, Craig Kapfer, and my dog Summer, who listens patiently to my agonizing over plots and dialogue without complaint. Very special thanks to Pat Morris for her skillful editing, subtle suggestions, encouragement, and support. She did not edit the acknowledgments, so do not blame her for the mistakes. Thanks to Julie, my wife, and sometimes the writing widow for your love and support. Chapter 1, Sunday. Peter, the receptionist called out as I headed to my office. I circled back to the nook where the receptionist sat behind a desk. Connie, who usually had a sunny smile that lit her face, looked troubled. "Can you go up to Axel Olson's room?" she asked. "Everyone else is busy, and his neighbors are complaining that Tucker's dog is howling." I did a quick time check and saw that I had more than an hour before I was scheduled to make a batch of popcorn and show the Sunday afternoon movie. "Sure," I said. I heard Tucker baying frantically and scratching at the door before I arrived at Axel's apartment. I knocked and called Axel's name. That only served to heighten Tucker's anxiety. I knocked a second time, wondering if Axel had gone out and left Tucker home alone. I waited as long as I thought it would take for Axel to hoist himself out of a chair and walk to the door. I tried the knob, but it was locked, so I took out my passkey and opened the door a crack. Tucker stopped baying and jammed his nose into the open crack. He scratched at the edge of the door and whimpered until I lifted him up, all 45 pounds of him, and held him to my chest. "What's the problem, Tucker?" I asked as I scratched his floppy ears and pushed the door open. He was panting as if he'd run a race, and I noticed that something reddish-brown stained his feet. "Axel, are you home?" I called. I stepped down the short hallway past Axel's kitchen and bathroom, peeking into each room as I passed to make sure it was empty. As I neared the living room, Tucker began to whimper. Axel was lying on the floor in a pool of blood that had apparently leaked from a small hole in his chest. I had an instant flashback to Iraq, where I had run to a Hummer that had been upended by a roadside bomb. I again saw the young corporal lying face up on the dusty road, looking unharmed except for a trickle of blood from the corner of his mouth, but totally dead. I broke out in a sweat. Tucker's whining cleared the image and got me back to the present. The carpet was dotted with bloody paw prints where Tucker had raced around his master after he'd fallen. I carefully stepped around the blood and put two fingers on Axel's neck, checking for a pulse, while Tucker whimpered in my ear and tried to lick my face. Axel's skin was already cool to my touch, and there was no pulse. Suspecting suicide, I looked around for a gun but didn't see one. That's when it struck me that Axel had been murdered. With Tucker securely clamped under my arm, I retreated on roughly the same path that I had used to enter the room and stood at the door while I dialed 911 on my cell phone. My second call was to the nursing supervisor, who was in the elevator before we ended the call. The third call was to the director, who was rendered speechless by the news of Axel's murder. I set Tucker down and stood outside Axel's door, awaiting the arrival of Jenny, the nursing supervisor. I was having a hard time wrapping my head around the possibility that Axel had been murdered. Kathy, the director, had once described Axel as a demanding resident. I found him to be condescending and arrogant, often taking verbal potshots at my efforts to provide recreation for the residents on a shoestring budget. I'd often heard him insult others, too. He took apparent joy from making people squirm. I wondered if he'd finally pushed someone too far. I stared at the thermometer mounted on a rough-hewn timber that supported the portico. It read 50 degrees. I was chilled to the bone and feeling colder than 3 months ago when the thermometer had shown minus 34. The sharp easterly wind off Lake Superior tugged at my windbreaker and pants, even though I was nestled between the building and a large cedar tree. Tucker, a basset hound and St. Bernard mix, who looked like a shaggy mop with floppy ears, sat shivering at my feet, looking even more forlorn than your average basset. His droopy eyes fixed on me, I stared across the expanse of brown grass that had been packed under a heavy blanket of snow for the previous 6 months. A soggy black glove, newly exposed by the melting snow, lay near the row of residents' cars. Movement caught my eye, and I watched a white plastic shopping bag with a red logo from the convenience store down the road blow past, rolling along like a tumbleweed. The next to last thing I wanted to do on a miserable Sunday afternoon was freeze my fanny waiting for the Two Harbors police while minding the dog. The only thing worse than this duty was the nursing director's job. Jenny was stationed inside Axel Olsen's room to make sure that no one disturbed anything. Actually, it was a crime scene, but I had a hard time thinking in those terms. Considering that Whistling Pines is a senior citizen's assisted living community with controlled access, it seemed terribly unlikely that it could be a crime scene. The biggest crime anyone could remember was when Phyllis, Phil Melson, reported someone had stolen her glasses. It turned out that Phil had sat on them and her sister Catherine, Ole Olson, had delivered them to Bluston Optical for repair. It took 2 days of searching before Ole delivered the repaired glasses and the mystery was solved. The whine of a siren grew louder as one of the Two Harbors policemen made his way through the sparse afternoon town traffic. I had a vision of the cop sitting in Judy's cafe drinking coffee and chatting up the waitress when the radio call told him to investigate a suspicious death at Whistling Pines. Two Harbors is a small town 22 miles east of Duluth, strategically located on a railhead that delivers iron ore pellets from Minnesota's Iron Range to the ships that ferry the ore across the Great Lakes to the steel mills on Lake Michigan and Lake Erie. There wasn't much more crime in Two Harbors than there was at Whistling Pines, especially when the summer tourists are gone. The tourists overindulge in the scenery, alcohol, Lake Superior, and the local eateries, which tends to lead to some emergency calls for the ambulance and the police. When the 3,000 locals reclaim the town for the 9 months between Labor Day and Memorial Day, the population drops by 50% and life gets pretty quiet. Most of us actually prefer the cold weather months to the summer months, or what many of us call the poor sledding season. The siren stopped a couple blocks away and the muddy black and white squad car eased through the parking lot and pulled under the portico. Len Rents, the Two Harbors police chief, unfolded himself from the car and nodded to me as he closed the door and adjusted his duty belt, which hung precariously from his bony hips. I'd met Len when I was trying to sort out my life and was considering law enforcement as my future. That was before a tour of duty in Iraq left me with little interest in law enforcement, and before I'd found out that I really enjoyed working with the elderly. I didn't expect that our paths would collide head-on at my new job as the recreation director for Whistling Pines. "Peter Rogers, how are you?" Len said, shaking my hand, then bending down to rub Tucker behind the ear. "Tell me that the 9/11 call was a crank and that there really isn't a dead body inside." "There's a dead body, Len," I said, leading him into the lobby with Tucker trotting along on his stubby legs. I held my comments until we passed a crowd of retirees gathered around the reception desk under the stuffed moose head. I led Tucker around the desk to Connie and asked her to keep an eye on him for a while. Hazel Perkins separated from a group of women gossiping about something and pushed her walker over to confront Len. "Well, if it isn't the police chief." "Did someone finally realize that the food here is a crime?" she asked as the other gossips followed behind her. "No," he replied, patting her on the arm. "We found out that Peter's been running an unlicensed bingo game and I'm here to lock him up." The ladies laughed as we eased past to the elevator. "Peter's problem is that his programs always start late. He's just not punctilious," Hazel called out as the elevator dinged and the doors opened. "Punctilious?" Len asked. "Doesn't that mean overly picky?" "I'm sure Hazel meant punctual, but got the words confused," I explained as the elevator closed. "I had to delay the start of yesterday's bingo because the kitchen ran out of chocolate cake. There was an uprising until a cook's defrosted some brownies." Len gave me a skeptical look. "Really," I said, "desserts are very important." "Tell me about the dead body." As the elevator blinked too, I said, "Axel Olsen is dead, and I think he was murdered." "What makes you think it's murder?" Len asked as we watched the floor numbers change slowly to 3. Everything at Whistling Pines moves slowly, even the elevator. "The hole in his shirt, the pool of blood on the floor, and I didn't see any weapon," I replied as the elevator doors slid open. "Hole in his shirt?" Len asked. I pointed to my solar plexus as I led him to room 311 and took out my passkey. Len put a hand on my arm and looked me in the eye. "What have you touched?" I nodded and unlocked the door. "We had a complaint that Axel's dog was barking. When he didn't answer my knock, I tried the door, which is usually unlocked, then used the pass key to let myself in. When I saw Axel on the floor, I backed out and called 911, and then I called the nursing supervisor, who also touched the knob. So we touched the doorknob, both coming and going. His dog, Tucker, was racing around like a whirling dervish, tracking blood all over the carpet. I didn't realize that it was a crime scene until I saw Axel. Len pulled on a pair of purple plastic gloves, then handed me a pair. He opened the door, touching only the knob, and moved past me into the narrow hallway to the bedroom living room. Jenny, the nursing director, who's also my girlfriend, turned to face us. Her lavender smock with yellow ducklings seemed a little out of place in this death scene. Len stopped at the edge of the living room and took in the scene. I looked around the room, too, like I was seeing it for the first time. The walls, drapes, and carpet were all beige. The kitchen table was bare except for a deck of cards and a cribbage board. The four chairs were pushed against the table. Everything was orderly, from the pile of mail on the table next to Axel's recliner, to the neatly made bed, to the kitchen countertops that were bare except for a plastic water glass next to the sink. The one exception to the order was an 8x10 framed photo that had been knocked from the wall. Tiny shards of broken glass sparkled among the carpet fibers. "Hey, Jenny," Len said softly, "mind if I take a look?" She stepped aside and said, "He's dead. Peter checked for a pulse before he called me, and then I double-checked with my stethoscope." She watched Len approach the body, crossed her arms, and shivered. I didn't know what else to do. There wasn't any point in administering CPR. Len squatted down next to Axel's body, which was lying on its side. Axel was a trim man who had a full head of dark hair that was reportedly helped with Grecian formula. He was dressed in a yellow golf shirt and khaki pants. Other than the blood, he looked amazingly peaceful. Len studied the scene for several seconds, taking in details about the body, its position, and the room. Len's skinny frame reminded me that many local teens referred to him as Barney Fife, having watched reruns of the Andy Griffith Show on Nickelodeon. Len was cool with that view. He took his job seriously and preferred to masquerade as Barney when he was, in fact, a shrewd investigator. He'd solved the few local crimes within hours. We lived in a town that was a snippet from the past, where most people didn't bother to lock their houses and even left their car keys in the ignition so they wouldn't get lost. That carried over to Whistling Pines, where it was rare to find a locked room other than the nursing office where medications and emergency equipment were stored. After a few minutes, he stood and shook his head. "The dog really made a mess in here. He left little bloody paw prints all over the place. The crime scene guys will love that." He motioned for us to follow him out of the room. "I want you to secure this room until the BCA gets here. Peter, can you lock the door and sit here until I can get one of my guys here?" I looked at my watch. "I've got to start the afternoon movie in about half an hour. It would probably be good to keep the residents occupied as long as possible before the rumor mill starts spinning." "I'll get one of the aides to make popcorn and get the movie set up," Jenny offered. "Maybe an aide could stand here and I could set up the movie," I countered, hoping I wouldn't have to guard Axel's body. Len was shaking his head. "I think it's best if you stay here, Pete. No need to spread the news around to any more people than necessary." "Fine," I said with resignation. "Jenny, will you bring me a chair?" "I'm sure the sheriff's department heard the call, and they'll be here shortly," Len said, as he pulled out a dog-eared notebook and started flipping through the pages, looking for a phone number. "I'd prefer if the deputies and the coroner didn't traipse all over the crime scene before the crime lab gets here. It's enough of a mess with the dog's paw prints already, and they have a tendency to get overexcited and walk on the trace evidence." Len apparently found the number he was seeking. He pulled out his cell phone and punched in the phone number. It was answered quickly, and he said, "This is Len Rents, the Two Harbors Chief of Police. We have a murder scene, and I need a mobile crime lab." "Jenny," he said, pulling the phone away while he waited for someone else to come on the line, "I assume that You have an emergency contact for Axel? Jenny nodded. I've talked to his daughter a couple times, and I think that he has two sons, too. I can get their phone numbers for you. Does he have any other regular visitors? Not that I know of, Jenny said, shaking her head. I've only seen his daughter here once, and I've never met his sons. Axel tended to be a little abrasive. He didn't have many people that you'd call friends. I'll contact his children, Len said. Copy the numbers for me, and I'll pick them up on my way out. I'd never seen Jenny so distracted. She was usually the pert, competent nurse, but Axel's death seemed to unnerve her. Her rosy cheeks had drained of color, making her face look ashen against her blonde hair. Len's request for the next of kin information was the catalyst she needed to get into motion. Sure, she said, and quickly darted off. Len and I watched her walk away. While she waited for the elevator, Len looked back to me. I bet she doesn't get much sleep tonight. Len's cell phone was on speaker, and a booming male voice startled us. This is Special Agent Riker. I understand that you're requesting the mobile lab. Can you give me a little more information? This is Chief Rentz from Two Harbors. We've got a homicide, and I run a 10-man show. We're not equipped to handle a forensic murder investigation. I've got a couple investigators in the mobile crime lab looking at some burglaries in Eveleth. I think I could have them here after supper time. Will that work for you, Chief? Len chuckled. I've got no other options, so I guess that'll be fine. Have them call my cell phone, he told the agent. Pete, unless you have an objection, Len said as he folded his cell phone, I'd like to use you as my inside guy. I'd like you to watch for anyone who's acting strange and anything that seems out of the ordinary. I knew where Len was going. I'd been a music major at the University of Minnesota's Duluth campus for 2 years, but I wasn't sure what I wanted to do and was getting burned out from the long hours of practice. I took one criminal justice class because police work seemed a lot more interesting than practicing music. Near the end of the course, each student was assigned a ride-along with a local police officer. Len let me ride with him every night for a week. What I quickly learned was that police work, much like music, was hours of mind-numbing repetition interrupted by a few minutes of adrenaline. Like the night we got called to a liquor store robbery, and I chased and tackled the robber while Len jogged along behind us. At that point, I decided it was time for a total change of direction. I joined the Navy, became a corpsman, and was deployed to Iraq near the end of my enlistment. My time as a corpsman taught me invaluable life lessons, including those that made me sure that I didn't want to reenlist, pursue a career in medicine, or be a cop. Before the Navy, I'd invested 15 years of my life in the piano, so I went back to the university and completed my music degree. Every time I see Len, he tries to change my mind, in part because he's thinking about retirement and because he thinks I'm level-headed and that I'd make a pretty good cop. I think that you'd be better off with Kathy, the director, I suggested. She has access to much more than I do, and she's really professional. I blurted out the first thing that came to mind, and it really sounded like I was trying to duck out of the responsibility. Kathy's not the right person. Kathy's not the right person. Her job will be to keep the Whistling Pines name out of the mud, and all else be damned. Len started patting his pockets in an obvious search for something. I shouldn't have quit smoking. The nicotine gum is fine, but it's just not as satisfying to chew and think as it is to light up a pipe and think. So, why me? I asked, as Len popped a piece of nicotine gum out of a plastic bubble. I trust you to keep your mouth shut and to pass along whatever may come up without putting it through a what-will-this-look-like-on-the-front-page-of-the-paper kind of a filter. Besides that, I will want to convince you to give up the old people's chauffeur job to get your law enforcement license. The residents may be a little fuzzy at times, but they don't shoot at me or try to run me down with their cars. I hesitated, remembering an incident earlier in the day. Sometimes they do try to run me down with their wheelchairs, but unless they're motorized, I can usually dodge them. Len shook his head and said, "Just keep the riffraff out of Axel's apartment until the BCA gets here, and keep your eyes open. I'll be around here a lot over the next few days. Let's plan to have a daily private chat for a while." And with that, he was gone, his cell phone held to his ear. Len hadn't been gone 10 minutes when I heard more sirens. The whine had hardly died when two brown-shirted deputies burst through the doorway at the top of the stairs and spied me sitting next to Axel's door. I had a bad feeling. I recognized both of them from the local eateries. It struck me that they looked like Abbott and Costello, one short and pudgy, the other tall and lean. The lean one was all smiles. He looked at my name badge and put out his hand. "Pete, I'm Deputy Harris, and this is Deputy Barnes. I hear that you're the man who found the body and that you're keeping civilians out of the crime scene." After shaking hands, Deputy Barnes reached for the doorknob. When he twisted the knob, it resisted, and he stepped back. "It's locked?" Len asked me to keep it locked. "Well, we're here to look at the crime scene. Unlock it." I could see this was all going downhill fast, but I couldn't find a path out quickly. "Nope. Len asked me to keep it locked until the BCA crime lab gets here." The smiles were gone. "You have a key, right?" I looked down the hallway and measured my chances at making it to the stairs before they caught me. I figured I could outrun Barnes, but Harris looked like he might have been a sprinter. Yes? "Well then, use it," Barnes said. I started to answer, but the words stuck in my throat. I finally managed to croak out, "No." "No?" Harris looked incredulous and Barnes was turning red. "Len told me to keep the riffraff out." As soon as the words were out, I wished that there was some way to unsay something. "And we're riffraff?" Barnes asked through clenched teeth. I was tempted to count his heart rate on the vein that was pulsing on his neck. "Well, it's complicated," I stalled. "We're bright guys," Barnes said, his voice dripping with sarcasm. "Explain it, and we'll try to catch on." "Len said..." I paused and tried to find some words that wouldn't sound as insulting as Len's directive to me. "He said to keep people out so that no one walked all over the trace evidence and screwed up his crime scene." The words tumbled out so fast that I couldn't understand them myself. Both Barnes and Harris were staring at me in disbelief. I was waiting for Barnes, who was now the shade of an overcooked beet, to explode. He broke out in laughter. "That sounds just like something that old codger would say. I'll bet he's around a corner listening to this just to see if you'd really tell us that." Barnes looked down the hallway to see if he could spot Len. Harris nodded his assent. "Tell you what, Pete, open the door and show us where you and Len have already walked, and we'll follow your footsteps and approach no closer."
You've been listening to Tom Kohler's reading of Whistling Pines, self-published by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. It is the first of a 4-part series of books by Hovey set in Two Harbors. Thanks to Mr. Hovey for permission to share Whistling Pines on Literally from the North Shore. This was episode 1 of a total of 15 episodes, and you can tune in again tomorrow for episode 2. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you will find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the homepage. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs. Tune in again tomorrow at 1 p.m. for episode 2 of Whistling Pines.